This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Well over half of NFL players today are African American, but there was a time not that long ago when there were none. George Taliaferro grew up in Gary, Indiana, and became the first African American drafted by the NFL. But his career after football made a big difference as well. Today, we'll talk with the author of a recent biography about the Indiana native. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and your quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is Don Knight, the author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. Don, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you first hear about George?
I was actually a student in his social work class at Indiana University.
Wow, you were a student. Okay.
I was. And actually, I took it because my roommate had taken it and she kept bugging me and said I had to take this class. I was an ed major, so I didn't really need a social work class, but I finally caved in and took the class. And he was such an amazing person.
I don't want to date you, but when was this?
This was in about 91.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And how long had he been at IU at that point?
Well, he had been a student there himself, which I'm sure we're going to get to eventually.
Sure, sure. But he had taught elsewhere before he came back to IU to teach.
Correct. And actually, he came back to IU in the early 70s as a special assistant to President John Ryan. Hmm. He was helping implement affirmative action across all 8 IU campuses. And then he ended up teaching social work there as well.
So why write a book about him?
Well, he never mentioned during that entire semester that he had once played football at IU or that he had been drafted by the NFL, that he was the first black quarterback. I stayed in touch. My roommates and I all stayed in touch with him, actually. And we were at a dinner years after we had graduated, and I heard somebody say, "When you played football here." And I said, "What do you mean? You never mentioned that you had played football here." And his friend said, "Well, then you didn't know he was the first black man drafted by an NFL team or the first black quarterback." And I said, "What?" And it just occurred to me, you know, that here is this not just Indiana treasure, but national treasure. And people needed to know. So that's why I decided to write the book.
He died about 2 years ago, but you were able to interview him for the book a number of times. Over the years you worked on it, right? How many times did you get to talk to him? Sounds like several.
Oh, many. In fact, there was actually an original biography that came out in 2007. And I had spent about 10 years working on that one. So I can't even count the number of times that I interviewed him. But on our way to the first book signing, he actually told me a story about how Nat King Cole had serenaded him and his wife when they were in Los Angeles for the Pro Bowl. And I went, "Oh, my God, I'm so bad at this. That should have been in the book." So immediately I started collecting other stories about George and from George. We spent a lot of time together promoting the first book. And he was a friend, you know, who I stayed in touch with. So he often told me random stories and I'd say, "Hold on, I need to get a pen." So anyway, long story short, I decided to rewrite it and I knew it was coming for a long time. But when the national anthem protests started and there was a lot of vilification of the athletes doing that and there was a lot of polarization and I felt like Taliaferro and other athletes like Taliaferro gave us a really unique lens with which to look through this issue and that could maybe give us some understanding. And so that's when I decided I really needed to rewrite it.
I've heard a few different pronunciations. Taliaferro is the one you use?
Correct.
And is that the one he used?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then the ones that by the sports pundits that I've heard are not the correct ones.
Yeah, I hear a lot also.
Well, the book starts with it. So is the first book very different from this new book? Would you call this a second edition almost, or is this a completely new book?
It's really a completely new book, although some of the original stories are there. It's a lot richer as far as the details. I also included other athletes that I think give us more of that. And that's why the title is Race and Football in America, because I think it goes well beyond Taliaferro's story. There were a lot of athletes who experienced similar issues. And I think it's really important to look at all of those and get a better idea for what that meant.
He was born in Tennessee. but he grew up in Gary, Indiana, after his family moved there when he was an infant. What was Gary like back then?
So he said Gary was ideal, that it was a perfect place, a perfect melting pot, and everyone got along. It was a steel town, and there were immigrants from all over. And he said that they would all pitch in the neighborhood. But it was also interesting because there was all black Gary Roosevelt High School, all white Emerson High School, and then there was integrated Gary Frabel High School. So it was kind of an interesting mix for the time period. This is, 1945, 46, that era. So he said it was ideal.
We're talking with Don Knight, author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. And he wanted to be a boxer.
That's right.
When he was young. But it sounds like his mother shot that idea down pretty quick.
She did, yes.
And why was that?
She was really worried about him getting injured. And in fact, when he finally begged her to play football, that took a lot of convincing. She actually insisted that she would do a physical. And he said that very few people could have passed his mother's physical.
Wow. Let's see. It seems like his decision to get into football was a sudden one. And it almost sounds like he just randomly picked a sport. Did he talk about why he gravitated to football?
Yeah. He says he was lucky that he didn't realize that football was kind of an unattainable dream for him, because there were black boxers. There were not a lot of black football players. But he also played a neighborhood game called Cock the Rooster. That was a very similar game to football. They had a football and they just tried to tackle people. And he credited that game with why he was so good at football. But he played at his high school and he was so good that that's how he really ended up getting into it.
And so then how did he end up at Indiana University?
Well, that's a great story. So because Gary Roosevelt was an all-black school, they weren't allowed to play in any postseason tournaments. East Chicago Roosevelt was a powerhouse. I think they had gone a good couple of years undefeated. I think 34 games straight they had won. And their coach, Pete Rusinski, wanted to play a game. They had a bye week or something before a tournament game, and he wanted to play against a competitive team for practice, and he knew Gary Roosevelt would be available. So he contacted Bo Mallard, the coach at Gary Roosevelt, and said, I want to play you guys. So they did. And Gary Roosevelt actually beat East Chicago Roosevelt with a George Taliaferro touchdown at the end. So East Chicago's coach was a good friend of Coach Bo McMillan at IU. And he called him and said, you have got to get this kid at IU.
At that time, How many black players were playing for IU or really any college teams?
Okay, great question. So IU had several, and some of them were starting. Notre Dame had zero. Purdue had zero. So it's really interesting. But when George arrived at IU, the campus was segregated, and he wasn't even permitted to live on campus.
This was in the mid-40s, 1945?
Correct. He arrived there in 1945.
Okay. And so so he was playing with a few other African-American players.
That's right.
Yeah. But was he emerging as sort of a superstar at that time?
Yes. Yeah, so Indiana University was undefeated in 1945, and George Taliaferro was the star.
Quarterback?
He played several positions.
Yeah, he was all over the place.
He was. In fact, in the NFL, he played seven positions on both sides of the ball, and he still holds that record, which will probably hold forever at this point since
wow.
It's so specialized now. He did not play quarterback for IU, but he often was a passer. So the way the game was played with this old single wing formation, sometimes the ball would get snapped to him even though he wasn't in the quarterback position.
How different of a game was it then from the way it is now? I mean, we see photos of George and you see the leather helmets, no face masks. Was it the same game that we play today?
I mean, to some extent, but obviously, yeah, it was very different also, and it wasn't specialized. So he played on both sides of the ball pretty much every minute of the game.
Wow. So he didn't really get the kind of break that a lot of players nowadays
do. No, he did not. He also says they had fewer concussions because they didn't have face masks, and he said they knew how to tackle.
Okay, so they kind of had to be a little bit more careful, whereas now, because they have all the protective equipment, it's a little more reckless?
That's right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's his theory anyway.
Okay. Interesting one. So what was his freshman year like? Let's go back a little bit. How much of an impact did football seem to have on his life in Bloomington? It was his whole life, it seems like.
It was. In fact, when he arrived, he was pretty shell-shocked. He had a level of confidence going into it that upon arrival, I think he discovered it wasn't what he thought it would be. He was very upset to find that he couldn't live on campus. He felt like a big part of education is meeting other people from different places. And so he was upset he wasn't going to be in the dorm. Instead, he lived off campus at the Mays House, which was a house for black football players. A private family took them in, and it was sort of a dorm for them. And then he got in line for equipment, and everyone was huge. And he was just kind of dumbfounded by the size of the other players. And he called his dad and said, "I want to come home."
Ooh.
And his dad said, "Is there another reason why you're there?" and hung the phone up on him. And so George stayed up all night thinking about it and remembered what his mom and dad had told him every day of his life. "We love you. You must be educated." And he realized that football was a means to that education. And at the end, he said, "Football, you know, that racism was a small price to pay for the education I received there."
But it was a price, and it was a fairly significant one. He wasn't able to live on campus.
Right.
He was in this sort of segregated dorm, taken in by a family. It sounds like that wasn't even sanctioned by the university.
Right. Well, I think it was part of the university and was sort of university housing. I know it's a completely different time period and kind of hard to wrap your head around.
It really kind of is.
But he... You know, he said that he never met a black person who failed out of IU because they didn't have anything they could do. So they went to class and they studied hard and they knew it was a means to an end.
We're talking to Don Knight in the studio today. Don is the author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. After the break, we'll hear more about George's time at IU and his experience in the U.S. Army. And we would love to hear from you. Send us your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking about the life of George Taliaferro, the Indiana native who was the first African-American to get drafted by the NFL. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Were you at IU when George was teaching there? What do you remember about him? Or maybe you're just an IU fan and you've heard a lot about George. Let us know. Voicemail 866-476-3881 or catch us on social media. In the studio, we're joined again by Don Knight, author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. He grew up in Gary, Indiana, and was the first African-American to be drafted by the NFL. And we left off by during his freshman year at IU. And this was right after the end of World War II. And he was then drafted by the U.S. Army before his first year was up, right?
Yeah, that's right. Right at the end of his freshman year. So he found out he would not be returning to IU for his sophomore year.
And where was he sent?
He was sent to Camp Lee in Virginia, where he was also a football player. So he remained in what was considered sort of the entertainment view of the military. He never left the States. I mean, he actually says that when he got there, it was some Michigan players who told him that their coach actually got him drafted into the Army because they didn't want to have to play against him his sophomore year.
Is that true?
I have no idea.
It sounds like it could just be guys joking around, but that's a pretty high honor, I guess, to be even told that, whether it's true or not.
Right, right.
And so how did he describe his time in the Army?
He had some very similar experiences. Games in the South, for example, they were playing a game in Fort Benning, Georgia. And when they arrived, there were six black players total. When they arrived, the black players were taken to a different barracks in what was called Sandtown, a much inferior barracks. And they didn't get the same food, same quality food. And so Taliaferro basically decided he wasn't going to play in the game the next day because of that. And the other five players decided to join him. He said, "This isn't your fight. You don't have to do this." And they said, "No, we agree with you. We should be treated equally. We're in the Army fighting for our country, so to speak." And so he ended up getting called in by the CO of Fort Benning, who said, "Soldier, you can be dishonorably discharged." And George said, "Then you better start doing it because I won't play." Well, they ended up sending a weapons carrier to move the six black players to the same barracks as the white players. And the next day they played against the Doughboys. And from what I understand, it was the first time that black players had played against white players in Georgia.
Interesting. Can we go back to, it was Sandtown, you said?
Sandtown.
It was called Sandtown. And these were just inferior facilities.
Correct.
In what way?
I think the white barracks were, you know, brick. These were just kind of shacks, I guess. He said they were fed kind of leftovers, didn't get the same food as his white teammates were getting.
So the white teammates would get food and then they would get what was left over.
Basically, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And anything else about the food? It seemed like that was really kind of a big point for him.
Well, I think it was the overall experience. The fact that they had to stay in separate facilities, the fact that they didn't warrant the same food, the same amenities. And he just felt like he didn't want to take that. So he decided he was going to take a stand. And this was really the first time that he realized that he had some power, I think, as a football player to do that. So it was kind of a pivotal moment.
So this was kind of the beginning of his activism.
That's right.
It seems like.
That's right.
How significant did this experience confronting leadership on the base seem for George, I guess, when he talked about it?
You know, I'm sure especially because he was so young, it did give him a level of confidence when you have the commanding officer of, you know, Fort Benning, Georgia, saying, "Okay, we'll move you." I feel like that probably gave him some confidence. And so when he went back to Indiana University the next year, he continued fighting segregation there as well.
And so was he then dishonorably discharged?
No, he was not.
He was not. Okay. Was he soon honorably discharged? Or did he continue to serve a little bit longer?
Well, so he was in for, I believe it was 16 months. And then he was given a 3-day pass while the rest of his unit was sent somewhere overseas, I believe to Japan. And he remained stateside and then ended up out of the Army. He says that it was because of his football coach at Indiana University who pulled some strings and got him back out. So I don't know why these Big Ten coaches had so much power with draft boards. I have no idea, but that was the story.
Well, they still have a good bit of power today as well.
True.
Something big happened while he was still in the service. He fell in love.
He sure did. He fell in love with Viola Jones, who was going to Virginia State College for Negroes. He actually went to watch their football practice and met one of the other students there who just decided he had to introduce the two of them. And that's how they met.
And it sounds like he really fell for her.
He did. In fact, before he left to go back to Indiana University, he asked her to marry him and she said no.
He had just met her?
A few months, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it sounds like that wasn't the first time he asked her to marry him.
That was the first. And she
wouldn't be the last, I guess.
It would not be the last.
What I mean.
That's exactly right. So that was the first time. They actually were engaged at one point and they broke that engagement. And so it was really the third time that it finally happened for them.
So he ends up back at IU. I guess when he made it back to IU, what was the rest of his football career like? I mean, before we're talking NFL time, I guess.
Right. So he goes back to Indiana University, and Coach Bo McMillan, who had become a very important mentor for him. And I want to stress that it was such an interesting time period. We talked about how campus was segregated and, you know, that he had to stay off campus, even though he was recruited to play there. But at the same time, Coach Bo McMillan was very much ahead of his time in race relations. He refused to separate his players when they played games in the South, for example, and he was starting black players when really no one else was doing that. At other schools, if they had black players, they were stacking them behind white players. They were moving positions from, you know, quarterback to receiver or something. And so McMillan was a little ahead of his time, and he was a very important mentor to George. He ended up taking a job with the Detroit Lions as their head coach. So George lost an important mentor. You know, he got along well with his new coach, but it was a different experience for him coming back. And then over Christmas that year, his father was accidentally shot and killed by his uncle.
Oh, wow.
So his second year at Indiana University was very tumultuous for him. And at that point, he considered dropping out to go work in the steel mill and take care of his mom.
Oh, wow. There's a lot there.
There's a lot going on.
There's a lot there. Let's
right.
Let's go back to the freak accident that killed his father. What happened?
His uncle had received a gun for Christmas, or had bought himself a gun for Christmas and was showing his father. They both thought it was unloaded, and the gun went off and shot his father in the side.
Oh, my goodness. And that really kind of wrecked George for a little bit.
Absolutely. So he considered quitting school, going to the steel mills. He ended up deciding to stay and finish that year because he felt like he just wasn't sure what to do. And over the summer, he worked in the steel mill in the same place where his father had worked. And the men who had worked with his father said, "Your dad didn't want you to be in the steel mill. He wanted you to be educated. You need to go back to school."
Mm.
So he did go back for a third year, but only for a third year. He got pretty beat up that third year at IU. The last game of the season, they just weren't playing the same quality football that they had been. I believe they lost to Purdue, this pains me to say it, 34-0 or 39-0 or something.
Oh, wow.
Like that. And he was pretty beat up. He said they took him off in a stretcher just because he was so exhausted and beat up. And he looked at his mom and said, "You know, I could at least be getting paid for this." And she was worried that if he quit, he would break ties with the university and never graduate. And again, that was something that his parents had always instilled, that he needed to be educated. So he actually said, "If I play pro football, I will have it written into my contract that I will finish my degree."
Hmm. We are talking with Dawn Knight, author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. When he returned in the summer of 1947, it was the same summer that Jackie Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. Did that seem to have an impression on him?
I don't know that he was. I'm sure he was aware of Jackie Robinson, and he talked at length about him and what Jackie Robinson went through. He realizes that Robinson's experience was a much lonelier one than what he went through when he was a trailblazer in the NFL, because there were other black players at the time. And they did have more of a support system than what Jackie Robinson had went through. And so there was he was aware at that time. Yes.
So he was paying attention to the sort of big cultural changes that were underway in the
right.
in the world. And you wrote, there's a chapter called 1947, A Volatile Time for Professional Football.
Yes.
Why was it volatile?
Well, there were two warring leagues, the All-America Football Conference and the NFL, and they were warring for players, and both were not doing well financially because they were spending so much money fighting each other. And interestingly, I think it was two Notre Dame players, two of the Four Horsemen, who were the commissioners of those two leagues, and who just were not getting along, Crowley and Layden. And so they were upping player salaries and doing what they could to try to steal players and things from each other. And it was pretty clear where it was going, that eventually it was going to be one or the other that survived.
I want to come back to Coach McMillan.
Mm-hmm.
Did he catch any flack for this sort of progressive way that he was running IU football and integrating it a lot more than other teams were?
I'm sure he did. I don't think he cared.
I mean, it doesn't sound like it. And it sounds like his career didn't take a hit. He ended up working professionally.
Right. He was this Texan who had this drawl, and he was a gambler, and he was this great personality. George told me another story about one of their trainers had had a bout of polio and was limping across the field at some point, and someone made a smart remark about it. And McMillan just said he had polio and started yelling. And you know, I think he was just someone who didn't take other people being mean to people. And he was very open about his feelings about that.
In his final years at IU, what was IU like, and IU football for that matter?
Well, the football wasn't as good. They were just okay. They were undefeated his freshman year and undisputed Big Ten champs. So, you know, they never achieved that again while he was there. But what he did achieve was using his status as an athlete to start desegregating Bloomington, Indiana. And that started with, there was a picture of that 1945 championship team in a restaurant called the Gables, which is now Buffalo's. And he couldn't see the picture in its entirety because he could only look through the window and see it. And he would cup his hands around his face and turn his head. And then he said, I could at least see half of it. And I was in that half. So he could see the picture part of it.
But he couldn't go into where the picture was.
But he couldn't go into where the picture was, correct. So he went to IU President Herman B. Wells and said, I have $1.25 in my pocket, and I have to run to the Mays home for lunch every day, barely making it back for class in time because I can't go to any of these restaurants, including the Gables. And so
Where my picture is up,
right. And so Herman B. Wells called the owner of the Gables, who said, if I let black kids in, other kids might not come in. And Herman B. Wells said, well, how about if I just make your restaurant off limits to all of my students then? And of course, that obviously changed his mind. And he ended up saying, I tell you what, George and one of his friends can come in and sit down and we'll see how people react. And so George and Mel Grooms, I believe one of his teammates, and they were both popular athletes, just came in and had lunch one day. And of course, no one complained. And I think, you know, that's part of that, having that status as an athlete. He was very popular on campus. And so no one complained. And so they said, then come back and bring dates. So they came back the next week, and it was four of them. And that kind of gave him that same feeling as he had had in the Army when they played that game in Fort Benning, Georgia. So he started helping to desegregate the movie theaters at IU as well in Bloomington.
Did he end up graduating from IU?
He did. He did leave after his third year there in what would have been his senior year. And that's important because at the time there was a rule that you couldn't become a professional football player unless the class that you started college with had graduated. But the class he started with was graduating, so he was eligible to play even though he wasn't graduating because of that year off in the Army. But he did come back in the summers and did graduate.
How did George find out he was drafted by the NFL?
He was working out in Chicago with some friends of his who were professional athletes already. I believe it was Earl Banks and Buddy Young and Sherman Howard. They had worked out in Chicago, and then they were going to meet for lunch. And they said, let's, you know, run home and shower. We'll go have some lunch. And Earl Banks came in to the restaurant and had a newspaper behind his back and said, guys, guess who got drafted? And they were all throwing out names, you know, who got drafted by the Bears? They all started throwing out names. They were all white, of course. And then he pulled the newspaper out. It was the Chicago Defender, and it said, George Taliaferro drafted by Bears. And that's how he found out that he was drafted.
It's not the way it is these days.
It is not. No.
You would find out right away,
right,
and it would be everywhere.
That's right.
So he found out from a friend who had a newspaper.
Correct.
Goodness. And so there was a dilemma with the decision, though. He had spent, let's go back, he had spent his entire childhood in Gary.
Right.
I'm sure as a fan of the Chicago Bears.
Yes. A childhood dream was to play for the Chicago Bears. So this could have been a dream realized.
Wow. But there was something else at play.
That's right. He had already made a verbal commitment to the Los Angeles Dons.
Just a verbal commitment.
Verbal commitment. That's right. Nothing had been signed of the All-America Football Conference. And I think a couple of things went into his decision. One, we talked about those player wars, and the AAFC was paying their players more. But also, he had made a verbal commitment to them, and his dad had taught them that a man is only as good as his word. Mm. In fact, he told me the time that he really learned that lesson. He had been asked to dig a garden, and he was tempted by some friends to go to the school or to the local pool. He fell asleep, and when he woke up, he asked someone what time it was and realized that his dad was going to be home in 15 minutes, and there was no way that garden was going to be done. So he ran home, got there just around the same time as his father, and his father was very disappointed and said, you know, son, a man is only as good as his word. So he stayed up that evening and dug it by lantern light.
We'll find out what he ultimately did, the decision he made, when we come back. We're talking about the life of George Taliaferro with author Dawn Knight. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion with Dawn Knight, the author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. George grew up in Gary, Indiana. He went to Indiana University and was the first African-American to be drafted by the NFL. As always, we would love your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from. That's at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Okay, so where we left off, he was trying to decide between, and it sounds like it might have been an easy decision based on what his dad had told him years before about keeping your word, trying to decide between keeping with his verbal commitment to the L.A. Dons and or going with his childhood dream of being of playing for the Chicago Bears, the team on which he had just been drafted by the NFL, which he found out by a newspaper that his friend met him to share the news. So what did he decide?
So he played for the Los Angeles Dons. And again, you know, that I think that shows the strength of the he considered his father someone he wanted to be like. And I think that lesson that his father taught him obviously stuck with him forever. I mean, he told me this story about digging this garden by lantern light. And so that idea that a man is as good as his word.
So how did his life change after he joined the Los Angeles Dons?
He had kind of an interesting professional experience then because of that volatility we talked about between the leagues. So after his first year with the Los Angeles Dons, the two leagues ended up merging. And the Los Angeles Dons was no more. The players went back into sort of a player lottery. And George ended up then playing for the New York Yanks.
Another team we don't know of anymore.
Exactly, exactly. And then the New York Yanks became the Dallas Texans. But all of these teams, they would last about a year, and they were still dealing with some financial hardships. And so the Yanks went under, the Dallas Texans went under, and then they became the Baltimore Colts. So he ended up eventually with the Baltimore Colts.
And how long was he with the Baltimore Colts?
He was with the Colts for 2 years. His second year with the Colts, he was dealing with some knee injuries and things and just wasn't playing the same brand of football anymore. And he ended up getting traded to the Philadelphia Eagles, which is where he ended his career. And with the Eagles, his injury just didn't heal and he realized it was time to retire.
And this was mid-50s?
Correct. Yeah. He played from 49 to 56, I believe.
And around the time when I are we going back to Los Angeles Don's time that he proposed to Viola for the third time?
Yes, that's right.
So it was early in his professional career. So we're kind of jumping around. But so he proposed to Viola the third time. And did it finally happen?
Yes, they did finally get married. And even that actually was an interesting story because he ended up getting snowed in at a game and he was supposed to be back in Washington, D.C. for the wedding. And his coach had decided they were not going to leave that night. And so he and some reporter found transportation and they flew to New York and then took a train and they somehow ended up back in D.C. a couple of hours before his wedding.
Just a couple hours before the vows.
Right.
Wow. But as I understand it, there was some time, a good bit of time that passed between that third proposal and the wedding.
Yes, they were just kind of, you know, doing what young people do. He's moving around to different teams and things like that. And so, yeah, they had some time in between. At one point, I think he was upset. That was right as he was shifting into becoming a pro player. And he was supposed to be playing in the college All-Star game against, the reigning NFL champs, which we don't do anymore because that would be a lot of injuries for the college players, I think, more than anything. But it was actually a huge game that was played every year. And she was supposed to come with him and didn't. And so I think he was a little upset with her for that. And so that ended things for a little bit again. So that's why it took so long. They just had some of those moments that young couples do.
Ups and downs.
Right.
But they stayed together for life after that.
That's right.
Well, that's a happy ending.
I asked her why. She said, I don't know. He just came after me, I guess.
So do you think he regretted turning down the offer to play for the Chicago Bears?
I asked about that, too. Every team he played for was a pretty abysmal record, even though he was a standout star and did very well himself. He was, a three-time Pro Bowler who had amazing statistics and played, like I said, seven positions on both sides of the ball, and he often carried the team. But he also said he wouldn't have met the people he met or traveled because Chicago was so close to Gary. He would have just been where he had always been. Mm. And he felt like those experiences really were formational. So even though, you know, he could have played maybe for a better team and for his childhood dream, he still felt like it was important that he had all of those experiences in all those places.
So he was the kind of guy who fought for better things. But if he didn't get better things, he looked on the bright side of what he had.
Always, always.
How did he spend his life in the years after football? Seems like family was a priority.
Family was definitely a priority. And he wanted to be an educator and a football coach. He wanted to be like his mentor, Bo Mallard at Gary Roosevelt and Bo McMillan at Indiana University. At the time, he was still in Baltimore, where they had moved when he started playing with the Colts. And so he applied to the Baltimore public school system, and he was told there are only two black schools and there aren't any openings at either one. And I'm flabbergasted by the fact that here you could have someone who played professionally. He wanted to teach PE and coach football. Imagine what he could offer. And they didn't have anything to offer him. He was very depressed by that and eventually decided to get his degree in social work, where he said he could just work with people, period.
Hmm. And so he did that.
And he did that.
Yeah. And where did he get his I don't understand. So he already had a bachelor's at this point.
Right. In education.
Bachelor's in education. So he went for a master's in social work?
Yes.
Where did he do that?
He went to Howard University, and I believe he had another degree from somewhere else that honestly I can't remember off the top of my head right now. So he was taking classes at Howard while they were living in Baltimore.
And so social work, master's in social work.
Right.
So did he then become a social worker?
He did. And he worked for the Prisoners Association for a while, where he was helping prisoners to try not to go back into that prison system after, and trying to help them work through whatever was going on that sent them there to begin with. So that was what he did for quite a while.
We're talking with Don Knight, the author of Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. And so social work then brought him with some into some activism with the Boys and Girls Clubs.
Yeah, he actually started the Boys and Girls Club in Bloomington, but he worked with the Boys and Girls Club in Baltimore to begin with. Yes.
So starting Bloomington's Boys and Girls Club was his affiliation with the Boys and Girls Clubs, of course, began in Baltimore.
That's right.
And learned so much about it that he's like,
exactly,
Bloomington has to
exactly
have this.
Exactly.
And it's surprising, I guess, that he didn't talk much later when he was asked about current sports controversies involving race, namely the Colin Kaepernick protest. What did he say about that? He must have had an interesting perspective considering what he went through.
He did. And actually, the first couple of times I asked him about it, he didn't want to talk about it.
He just flat out said, no, I don't.
He kept changing the subject, and I could tell he didn't want to talk. And so I would go visit him, once a month or so for the last couple of years. He was actually in Ohio at the time. Anyway, I would go to see him and take him to lunch and spend a couple of hours with him. And I asked him again at another one of those lunches. And he said, I don't like to talk about it because I know what he's going through. But what I will say is I have hope.
That was it. And that was it.
That was it.
Just left it at
that. That was it. That's right.
We have a listener voicemail. This is from Josh in Indianapolis, who has a story about George. Let's listen to that now.
Yes, my name is Joshua Weir, and I'm calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. I knew George Taliaferro and Mrs. Vi Taliaferro personally. I was part of Team Major Taylor, and we were one of the, I guess, the second black Little 500 team to race in the Little 500. And George Taliaferro was a great liaison to us, a great man, a great person to stay in contact with, which me and my family did. So I'm glad to hear this. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Josh was on Team Major Taylor.
That's awesome. I love that.
Did you hear from a lot of people like this who were personally impacted by George?
Oh, my gosh. Everyone called them Mama T and Papa T.
I heard Papa T. Heard Papa T before. Yeah.
Yes. So the Taliaferros, when they came back to Bloomington, one of the things that they decided was that they didn't ever want anyone to feel on campus like they didn't have someone. And really what they meant by that was, you know, black athletes. But it ended up being any athletes, anyone, even me. That's how, you know, they ended up Mama T and Papa T to me as well. They collected kids. I think we started numbering us. I think I'm daughter number 7 or something. So anyway, that's just who they were. And there are so many stories like that, that they were liaisons for those people who needed someone to help them, who needed to feel like they belonged. There were so many students who probably would have dropped out if it wouldn't have been for the Taliaferros.
He was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame in 1981. How did it seem like he felt about those kinds of accolades?
He was so honored to get any accolades like that. I'd still love to see him get into the NFL Hall of Fame. I think he deserves that too. He was tickled. He couldn't believe that anyone would honor him for just doing what he loved. In fact, that was his reaction. He would laugh or giggle and go, "Why would they want to give me an honor? I was just doing what I loved."
What was his life like in around that time? What was he doing in 1981?
He was teaching social work at Indiana University.
He was at IU. Okay, so by that point, yeah, because he made it to IU in the 70s.
Early 70s is the affirmative action, yes.
But that was after a couple of teaching stints at other universities.
Right. I think he was at Morgan State as dean and an assistant football coach maybe there. So he had quite a few different places before they landed back in Bloomington.
We have another listener voicemail. This one's from Sandy in Indianapolis asking about George's children. Let's listen to that.
Hi, my name is Sandy Ryberg calling from Indianapolis. My father-in-law was a professor at Indiana University during the time that George Taliaferro came back to IU to teach. And I also knew his daughter, Crystal, because she was part of the John Mellencamp band. And my brother was associated at one time with Mr. Mellencamp. I'm wondering about George's children. How did they become so musical? Thank you.
Yeah, George's children, a musical talent? Do we know about that?
I don't know, Crystal. I know Linda, Donna, Terry, and Renee. So I'm not sure who Crystal is.
Did he seem, though, professionally satisfied with what he accomplished and what he got through while he was looking back at his life?
Absolutely. In fact, the best part is that I think what he was most proud of was his family. He said, I am educated. My children are educated. My wife is educated. So I think the fact that education was big and that his family was so important was really what stood out to him as the most important parts of his life.
There are some kind of heartbreaking and really honest depictions of dementia at the end of the book.
Yes.
And this is, which is something that his wife, Viola, was suffering from. What was it like spending time with them during that and watching them deal with it?
That was a very hard thing to watch. So Viola was a judge in Indiana, and she actually, I think, did the first adoption for a gay couple in Indiana. There's a Viola J. Taliaferro bill. She was once the highest paid judge in Indiana. I mean, just she was an incredible mind. I believe she worked federally to help children. She was always involved in trying to make children's lives better and family law. And so to see her go through something and it was just such a terrible loss, and to watch George fighting desperately for his wife and you know, that was hard to watch.
That could be a whole other book.
Absolutely.
About Vi.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
She seems like she led an incredible life as well.
She did. Yeah. She absolutely did.
So what do you want people to know about George more than anything?
You know, there were so many lessons he taught. The reason I stayed in touch with him, and he was such an important mentor to me, despite the fact that I was an education major, I realized from the way he educated us that I wanted to be an educator like him. And so he became an important mentor to me in the education profession. He taught us things like, may our complacency disturb us profoundly today. He just wrote that on the board one day and left it there. And I'm sure it had something to do with the lesson of the day. But I remember just looking at the board going, complacency, okay, not doing anything, just, oh, yeah, I guess it should. You know, it was just one of those things. And he said, all sickness ain't death, which is something that one of his old bosses had said to him. And I realized that that was his life. All sickness ain't death. You can overcome these obstacles and be stronger at the end. He just had all of these life lessons to share. And I think it's so important to realize that when he stood in front of that classroom, Ballantyne Hall at Indiana University, you know, he had once had to sit in the back of that classroom and couldn't live on campus. And I think it's so inspirational to see how it came full circle that now he's in front of the classroom and I'm 26 years into a teaching career that I've largely modeled on those things that I learned from him. And I just think that impact is huge. And that had nothing to do with sports. That was his life.
Dawn Knight is author of the book Race and Football, The Life and Legacy of George Taliaferro. Dawn, thank you so much for coming in to talk about George's life.
Thanks for having me.
You can get the book wherever you get books. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. You can find a podcast of our show or any past show where you can, anywhere you get your podcasts. Tomorrow is the Friday Pitch-In, where we'll catch up on what happened at the State House this week with our State House reporter, Brandon Smith. And we'll hear from somebody trying to save Indiana Beach from closing. Plus, some Indiana-based financial advice for the rest of us. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.